town, Chicago is.
The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference is coming to Chicago for its one and only 2019 conference. You can meet and hear Ross Douthat, Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith, Aaron Wolf, Hans Feeney, and Will Whedon Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org. Chicago is. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Why is it that so many, not only evolutionary biologists and other branches of science that will glom onto the ideas that Darwin first introduced so long ago, but ordinary lay people who may not be as studied in such things, why is the idea of evolution so very attractive? Why do so many fall in love with it, almost desperately in love with the idea of evolution, and hold so tenaciously to it even when evidence mounts against the theory? Did Darwin, I think a lot of people assume that Darwin had a working knowledge of genetics. After all, isn't that the mechanism where all these mutations take place? And he had a working knowledge of the molecular basis for life. Did he? And how has Darwin's theory changed since he first promulgated it in Origin of Species? Joining us to talk about how DNA science undermines Darwinian evolution, Dr. Michael Behe. He's professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University. He's founding senior fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Education, and he's author of several books, including his latest, Darwin Devolves, the New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution. Dr. Behe, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
One of the things you say in Darwin Devolves is that it's easy to fall in love with evolution. Why is that?
Well, it seems to be doing interesting and exciting things. Think of the one common example is the peppered moth over in England. It turns out there was a species of moth that was lighter in color, but when the Industrial Revolution came around and tree trunks, where the moth oftentimes rests, turned darker, then a darker variety of the moth survived better and increased in the population. And it's kind of fun to think that, well, you know, nature adjusts itself, and maybe we humans can't mess things up with our pollution too much.
Most people assume that Charles Darwin had a working knowledge of genetics and of the molecular basis for life. Is that true?
Well, no, it turns out not to be true. Yeah, this does surprise a lot of people, but just like everybody else in his time in the mid-19th century, Darwin didn't know anything about the cell. The cell at that time was thought to be kind of a little glob of jelly, protoplasm, and people thought that maybe it would bubble up from even the sea bottom because it was so simple. So they had a pretty obscure view of the cell, and even molecules. We now know molecules are the basis of matter, but back then molecules were still kind of theoretical entities. And so the science of Darwin's day, and especially the biology of Darwin's day, was very much more primitive than what we have now.
Was there a solid set of what you call touchstone experiments at Darwin's time to act as any kind of foundation for Darwin's ideas?
Well, again, no. Nobody did experiments on evolution for a long time after Darwin. Darwin's theory was based mostly on his observations. Of course, he traveled around the globe in the HMS Beagle and stopped in South America and the Galapagos Islands and more than that. And what set him thinking about his theory was that he saw varieties of creatures in those distant places that were different from the ones that he saw in England. And nonetheless, they were similar. And he got to thinking, well, how is it that they are similar and yet different in different places? And that's when he came up with his idea of evolution by variation and natural selection. That is, if a if a member of a species is born in an environment with some difference from other members of the species, then it will have a natural advantage in the struggle to survive. And maybe that will allow its offspring to survive, too, if that variation is inherited. But there were no experiments. It was a theoretical construct.
You talk about three red flags that ought to alert us when evolutionary biologists are essentially just telling us stories, beginning with what you say is the frequent and gratuitous attribution of very complex, elegant things with just the word evolved or evolution. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's funny when you notice it. Many people don't notice it, and I guess that's what the power is. But you'll often see phrases like the giraffe's neck evolved so that it could eat leaves high in trees. But you could just rephrase that sentence and say that the giraffe has a long neck that allows it to eat in trees. We do not have any idea of how the giraffe's neck might have evolved by random mutation and natural selection. You know, what genes changed to allow it to grow longer? What other genes changed to allow it to tolerate the increase in blood pressure of having its head so high above its body? No work has been done on that, and yet that, and in pretty much every other circumstance in the popular media when evolution is brought up, things are phrased in a way that would give an unwary listener the impression that, oh yeah, we've got this covered. Science knows that these things have evolved. And that will, you know, kind of mesmerize an unwary reader and make it seem more powerful than it is.
You say that another of the red flags is when Darwinian evolution presents what you call the united front. What is that?
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at stories in the media. Darwin's theory is presented as pretty much certain knowledge, and that all scientists, or except for a couple of cranks, all scientists accept it. But if you go in the scientific literature or at meetings, you find that there's a strong undercurrent of dissatisfaction with Darwin's theory. And a lot of biologists who are not intelligent design supporters like myself nonetheless think Darwin's theory isn't going to be the final explanation. We need more to explain what's been discovered in biology. But nonetheless, that's what they say when they talk to each other. But when the community is facing an external criticism, then they act like the media portrays them, that in fact, yes, Darwin's theory is the explanation. No, nobody's dissatisfied with it. And you can read admissions of this behavior in the professional literature, but it doesn't seem like the media want to bring these things to the public attention.
The third red flag is, you say, the fact that biological studies of topics that ought to be far less complex than biological evolution still run into intractable problems. Give us an example of that.
Okay, sure. The diet advice, you know, what to eat and so on, that's always getting changed and kind of lampooned oftentimes in discussions. For example, it was only a couple of weeks ago that a government panel said that, well, you know those guidelines about eating cholesterol and how it would be bad for you. Well, never mind. We've changed our conclusions, and we now think that for healthy people, it doesn't matter, you know, how much cholesterol you eat in your diet. And yet, if you pause to think about it, this is just one tiny dietary factor that can be studied very closely in humans, in present-day humans, in large numbers, and the humans can even, you know, talk back and give the researchers answers to questions. But if it's so hard to know whether cholesterol is good or bad for you, you know, how can scientists claim to know that what drove the complex evolution of very great changes in organisms in the very distant past. You know, organisms that you can't study in detail anymore. And it turns out that I call that the principle of comparative difficulty. If an easier task is too difficult to do, then a harder task certainly is too. So if we can't figure out the effect of cholesterol, you know, we don't know how the eye might have evolved.
Dr. Michael Behe is our guest, author of the book Darwin Devolves. He's professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University. We're talking about how DNA science undermines Darwinian evolution. When we come back, a comparison to economics. We're destined to be Darwin's children this time.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Many patients are upset to learn that doctors don't take the Hippocratic Oath anymore.
National Review columnist Wesley Smith talking about his presentation at the 2019 Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference.
That's a real shame because the Hippocratic Oath protects patient safety. The speech I will give at the conference will describe the consequences of violating Hippocratic values in healthcare and the things that can occur in the healthcare system if we move away from Hippocratic medicine to a more utilitarian bioethics.
You can meet and hear Wesley Smith making the case for the Hippocratic Oath at the one and only 2019 Making the Case conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Attendance is limited to 500. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking how DNA science undermines Darwinian evolution. Dr. Michael Behe is our guest professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University. Dr. Behe, why do you compare evolutionary biology to economics?
Well, it's interesting that economics and evolutionary biology share a couple of interesting features. One is that they both have to deal with very complex systems. Economics with people, and there are factors such as supply and demand and taxes and embargoes and the level of education of a public and all sorts of things go into considering economic models. And yet, if you look at it, economic models, as many comedians know, aren't all that reliable, even in the short term. You know, no economic model will tell you where the stock market will surely be in the next month or two, let alone, you know, a national economy in a decade or two. And with evolutionary biology, they have the same problem. They deal with very complex systems, you know, life, and many, many factors affect it. And so they, too, would have a very difficult time explaining or predicting what might happen to a system. But it turns out that evolutionary biology is even worse because with economics, it kind of looks to see what organism is going to sell better, or which is going to survive better. And even with that limited mission, economics has a hard time in explaining why some goods do better than other goods. And economics does not even try to explain how the goods whose trading they study, how those arrived. And nonetheless, evolutionary biology not only says that they will explain who descended from who, but they promise to tell us how extremely complex systems would be put together. And I argue in my book, Darwin Devolves, that in fact, that is not a credible claim.
In that vein, give us some examples of those biological systems for which evolutionary biology, or as you say, any theory of life, must account.
Well, one is that the complexity of life is very, very far greater than we expected. And another is that the conclusions that we can draw from physical systems are limited. For example, you can just think of weather forecasting as an example of people trying to predict what complex systems are going to do. You just can't do so beyond a very short time scale. And that's actually known as the chaos principle, that you simply can't predict what complex systems are going to do more than a short time down the road. Nonetheless, you can discern whether another factor was involved in the production of a system, and that is intelligence, simply by looking at a system and seeing how the parts of it are arranged. And if they seem to be arranged for a purpose, like, oh, just say a mousetrap, you see the parts arranged for a purpose, you know that however it was put together, whether it was put together over a long time, whether it was put together by a person in a factory or a space alien or whatever, you know it was intelligently designed. And some of those systems that we've discovered in the cell, and science is really kind of going breakneck speed these days. One of the systems that has been discovered in just the past few years is a little insect called a plant hopper. And on the back of its legs, the plant hopper can jump further and faster than any other species. And it was just noticed because some improvements in equipment allowed microscopists to look even more closely and in greater detail at the legs of the plant hopper. And it was discovered that they have gears in them, that is, they have interdigitating gears on each of its legs, and they mesh with each other, and as it starts to jump, they push on each other, and that coordinates the legs and gives them the most power for the jump. But if you look at those gears, there's a strongly purposeful arrangement of parts, and no evolutionist has ever even attempted to explain how such a thing could have come about by Darwin's mechanism. And so that's the sort of thing, and much else besides, that any theory of life has to account for. And of course, I argue in the book that intelligent design is the best account for that.
Dr. Michael Behe is our guest. We're talking about how DNA science undermines Darwinian evolution. He's professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University, founding senior fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Education, author of several books, including his latest, Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution. When we come back, how has Darwin's theory changed over the years? After our conversation with Dr. Michael Behe concludes, we'll be playing Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. In the last half hour of the program, we'll play our four soundbites for you, and then you'll vote, and your vote will decide which is Soundbite of the Week. I'm Todd Wilkin. More on DNA science undermining Darwinian evolution after this. All we are is dust in the wind. Oh.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We shouldn't basically create a child library where parents check out their kids like books, you know, for a couple of hours at night or on the weekends. Families should mean something.
Is Scientology a cult? It's the paradigmatic cult. By understanding what happened with Scientology, we can, I think, get a better understanding of other ways in which new cults might arise.
Remember that the same Lord who spared Nineveh destroyed Sodom. That is to say that his patience is not without an end.
If she is going to lay this charge against the Catholic Church today, then she must also lay this charge against God our Father. In the Old Testament, she must lay this charge against Christ in his choosing of the apostles.
In a half hour, we'll play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. We'll be playing those four soundbites for you in their entirety, and then your votes will decide which will be soundbite of the week. In the meantime, we're talking about how DNA science undermines Darwinian evolution. Dr. Michael Behe is our guest, professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University, founding senior fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Education, and author of several books, including his latest, Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution. Dr. Behe, how has Darwin's theory been modified, changed, tweaked over the years?
Well, Darwin didn't know virtually anything about the cellular or molecular basis of life. He didn't know about DNA. He didn't know about how heredity worked. And he proposed some ideas that turned out to be utterly wrong. But over time, science did discover DNA, did do experiments, and found out how heredity works. So that knowledge required Darwin's theory to kind of be adjusted to have that new information folded into it. And people call that neo-Darwinism, just new Darwinism. And essentially, it's still Darwin's theory in the sense that it still invokes random changes, but now we know they're changes in DNA, so now we call them random mutations, plus natural selection. That is, if an offspring does better in its environment, then it will survive better. But now we include the fact that heredity is controlled by genes, and we know the processes that genes can undergo to endure mutations. And we also know that the cell, rather than being a little piece of jelly, is actually filled with complex molecular machinery. Literally, machines made out of molecule, like little trucks and buses, and much more than that. So none of that knowledge was available to Darwin.
So has the constant tweaking on Darwin's theory been necessary simply because Darwin's original theory was, while elegant, very primitive in terms of the actual understanding of the molecular basis for life?
Yes, that's right. His theory did okay with when you were talking about, you know, the colors of birds or large features like that. But once science started to discover the more foundational levels of life, well, then you have to tweak things around. You know, it wasn't until, you know, 40 or more years after Darwin that the science of genetics was started. You know, that was based on Gregor Mendel's experiments in the monastery garden in Austria. And so now we know that a number of factors affect inheritance, of which Darwin was completely unaware. Not only DNA, but some exciting new results in recent decades is that other things, you know, proteins, chemical modifications, and so on, can sometimes be inherited, and they can affect heredity as well. So Darwin's theory has to kind of try to keep up with these new results in science.
You talk about both mathematical and descriptive ideas that have been suggested to supplement Darwinism. Starting with the mathematical ideas, what kind of ideas have been suggested to kind of prop Darwinism up a bit?
These have all resulted, well, mainly resulted, I guess, from new knowledge of the genetics underlying life. And one prominent one is called neutral theory. And neutral theory was proposed in the 1960s, and it says essentially that, well, yeah, a lot of mutations happen in DNA and the proteins they code for, but the great majority of them do not affect survival, either in favor or against. Rather, they are neutral. They, you know, natural selection doesn't care what DNA unit is at this particular place or other. And that was kind of a shock, because here all these mutations are going on, and Darwin's theory says, well, they should affect the organism, but apparently they don't. And that results from our understanding of how the structure of DNA and genes and so on that he knew nothing about. And that's interesting, and people have studied that in great detail in the past 40 or more years, but neutral theory, by definition, cannot explain the complex and sophisticated functional machinery of the cell, because the mutations studied by neutral theory are not either favorable or harmful. They simply are not visible to natural selection. So it's fun. It's a fun theory, and it's true, and you can study some things about life with neutral theory, but it doesn't answer the basic question of how stunning apparatus of life might have come about.
What kind of descriptive ideas have been suggested to supplement Darwinism?
Well, there's kind of a handful of more descriptive ideas to cover stuff that Darwin didn't know about, and kind of the umbrella that's put over all of them is the extended evolutionary synthesis, Neo-Darwinism, once the molecular level of life was discovered and Darwin's theory had to be adjusted to accommodate it. The Neo-Darwinism was sometimes called the evolutionary synthesis, putting together genetics and biology and so on. And these guys name their stuff the extended evolutionary synthesis because there are things that cannot be accounted for even with the molecular data that we now have in hand. And one of the fun ideas in the extended evolutionary synthesis is something called niche construction. A niche, you know, little area of the world where some organism might live. And the folks there observe that, well, some organisms actively construct their environment, the environment in which they live. And as a matter of fact, Darwin himself kind of pointed to an example back in the 19th century of worms, earthworms, which kind of dig up the soil, and then the progeny of those earthworms have to adapt to the soil conditions that their own ancestors produced. And so there's more of a connection between an organism and its survival than was initially thought of in Darwin's formal theory. Another good example is termites. Termites construct mounds, and there's species of termite in Africa that can build mounds that are 40 feet high. And then the offspring of the termites live in the mound, and they have to adjust and adapt to that. So there seems to be some feedback, some crosstalk between inheritance and environment that Darwin's formal theory doesn't account for.
Do these attempts to supplement Darwinism, do they rescue it, the theory?
In my estimation, as I write in the book, although these newer ideas do point to some interesting things that they might have a chance of saying something about, none of them even try to explain the complex machinery of life, you know, the eyeball, the bacterial flagellum, and so on, other things that I've written about. For example, neutral theory can't, because it sticks to things that don't have an effect on survival. And things like niche construction, well, that's fine that you can make a termite mound, but that doesn't explain where it came from, and it doesn't explain how termites got there in the first place. And if you look through the literature, none of these folks, as I say, try to explain things like eyeballs or hands or other complex biological systems. So none of them really can help Darwinism on that score.
Tell us about what you call the most definitive evolution experiment ever conducted. What have we learned from it about random mutation at the molecular level?
Well, there's a man called Richard Lenski who works at Michigan State University. He's a professor of microbiology out there. And more than 30 years ago, he got the idea that he would just grow a flask of bacteria in his lab, and he seeded some bacteria in a flask that had enough nutrients for it to eat and reproduce about 7 generations or so. And since bacteria do it so quickly, that was just overnight. They would go through 7 generations. And the next morning he came in and took a little bit of that material from the old flask and put it in a fresh flask. And now the bacteria could grow another 6 or 7 generations, and he'd do it the next morning. And he's been doing it for 30 years now. And the experiment in his lab has now reached 70,000 generations of bacteria. And he was interested in doing this just to see what would change, how they would evolve. And over time, he did see that some bacteria would undergo mutations and would improve. That is, they would outgrow other bacteria, ones that didn't have that mutation in the flask. But when he first started, and for a decade after that, he couldn't track down what those mutations were, because they're changes in DNA at the molecular level, and the technology for looking at that did not come online until, say, the year 2000, and improved a lot after that. But when he was able then to track down those mutations later on, it turns out that the great majority of them broke genes that were already there, broke pre-existing genes. And by throwing away those genes, that improved the bacteria's ability to reproduce and survive in the flask. And I spend a lot of time in my new book, Darwin Devolves, because that wonderfully illustrates the point of the book, that now that we have the ability to look at what these mutations are that are being selected, it turns out that we're discovering that Darwin's mechanism works chiefly by squandering genetic information for short-term gain. It will throw things away in a minute so that it can outcompete anything in its immediate neighborhood. But breaking genes doesn't tell you how they got there in the first place. And a mechanism which readily breaks things does not look like much of a candidate to build them in the first place.
Is this why you say that Darwin's mechanism of natural selection is self-limiting?
Yes. It turns out that adaptation, that is the ability of a species to adjust to its environment and do better there, will come about mostly by this degradatory process, that natural selection will select some genes that have been broken by random mutation because they help it adjust to a particular environment. But as you start to throw out genetic information to adapt to one environment, then if a change in the environment comes along, then you are less able to adapt because you don't have as much flexibility as the species did at the start. And so eventually the species becomes limited in its ability to change and kind of gets stuck where it is.
What is Dolo's Law, and why is it important for this conversation?
Well, Louis Dolo was a biologist in the 19th century, and he kind of postulated that if a feature disappeared in an evolutionary lineage, then it would not appear again. it would not re-evolve there, he thought. So, for example, flight feathers in penguins. You know, penguins are thought to be descended from seabirds that could fly. Penguins can't fly anymore, so they will not, says Dahlo, re-evolve flight feathers. And this is kind of taken with a grain of salt by many biologists. But the question has reemerged now that we know about the molecular level of life, which Dahlo did not, and now that we also have fancy laboratory techniques that allow us to make genes that are thought to be the ancestral forms of genes that appear in modern organisms.
What is irreducible complexity?
Irreducible complexity, I made up that phrase. It's a fancy phrase, but it stands for something simple. It just means that you've got some old machine or a system or something that has a number of different components, and all of them have to be present and to interact with each other to produce the effect of the system. And a simple illustration of it is an ordinary mechanical mousetrap. It's got a wooden base, it's got a spring, another part called a hammer, a couple other metal parts. And for a basic mousetrap, if you take away any of those parts, it doesn't work. It's broken. It's not like it works half as well as it used to. And if you think about it, things like that are big problems for Darwin's theory of gradual change, gradual evolution by random mutation and natural selection. Because with an irreducibly complex system like a mousetrap, there is no function for natural selection to select until the system is pretty much put together. So it can't evolve gradually as Darwin envisioned. And the big problem for modern evolutionary theory is that the molecular machinery of the cell that has been discovered, practically all of it is irreducibly complex at various levels. And so it presents a big barrier to this gradual Darwinian evolution. And I pointed that out in an earlier book called Darwin's Black Box. And it's still, and that was written over 20 years ago, and it's still an unsolved problem. And in the meantime, biology has discovered even more and more complex systems at the molecular foundation of life.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Behe, professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University, about how recent and some past DNA science undermines Darwinian evolution. He's author of the book Darwin Devolves. When we come back, how does irreducible complexity and random mutation and natural selection, how do these interact with each other?
The meanest human cuts. It's goodbye to fins and gill slits, and it's welcome lungs and hair. It's a long, long way from Amphioxus that we all came from there.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
How do Christians live authentically in an anti-Christian society? Do we run, or hide, or fight? Do we blend in, or stand out? Are we all by our lonesome, or all in this together? Explore answers to these vital questions in the March issue of the Lutheran Witness, Life Together, Set Apart. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
My brother the Abe. My brother the Abe.
We're talking about how DNA science undermines Darwinian evolution. Biochemist Dr. Michael Behe is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Join us in Chicago for the one and only 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. There you can meet and hear Ross Douthat of the New York Times, Pastor Matt Harrison, President of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Wesley Smith of National Review, Pastor Hans Feeney of Lutheran Satire, Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine, and Pastor Will Whedon, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Attendance at the conference is limited to 500. Register before April 1st and take advantage of the early bird registration fee of $115, which includes three meals. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or send your check along with a downloadable registration form to Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. The 2019 Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Dr. Behe, before the break, we were talking about irreducible complexity. How does that and random mutation and natural selection, how do these interact with each other?
Well, it's this. We've always been taught that random mutation will supply variation for natural selection to select and for evolution to go forward. And it turns out that's correct, but what we didn't realize is that the random mutation breaks genes a lot more easily than it makes them. And so natural selection will increase the number of broken genes in an animal population. And so random mutation and natural selection act together to promote broken genes. Irreducible complexity, this need for a system to have two or more parts to work, it turns out that if you're waiting for a feature to have several parts, waiting for it to arrive by random changes, by random mutation, it takes a much longer time. It takes a lot longer than to get just one uncoordinated change. So the problem of the irreducible complexity for this new idea of devolution is that any irreducibly complex feature, or even things that are modestly coordinated, will take such a long time that every random mutation that breaks a gene, and you only need one to break a gene, will appear much more quickly and have the opportunity, if you're thinking of a large number of organisms in a species, one or more of them will always have a broken gene in this or that or the other position. And if that helps, those broken genes will be selected and increase in the population and dominate the population way before any feature of an irreducibly complex system might appear in the hopes of being selected. So the irreducible complexity really greatly exacerbates the problem for this random mutation degrading genes and natural selection selecting them.
You actually make the point that random mutation, natural selection have always functioned this way, always will function this way. Why is that a necessary point to make?
Well, when you talk with Darwinian biologists, they, since their subject matter or the foundation of their subject matter, molecules and DNA and so on, you know, wasn't able to be studied for a long time, well, they kind of got by imagining how natural selection and mutation might work. And it's been seen that in the history of life, there have been times when it seems that lots of creativity was going on, and one such time is called the Cambrian explosion, when a bunch of new sorts of animals were first seen in the fossil record. So some people think that maybe random mutation and selection had more flexibility back then. Evolution had more opportunities than it does now. But random mutation and natural selection are just dumb forces or more dumb things. And they had no more flexibility in the past than they do now. And as a matter of fact, if you look at organisms that are thought to be ancient, some bacteria, it was reported that there's a lot of new bacteria that hadn't been able to be seen because we only got the techniques to look at them now. And they are missing a bunch of genes that are present in other bacteria. So the most straightforward interpretation of that is that they had the genes in the first place and they lost them because it was beneficial at some point to jettison those genes. And we see the results now. So there is never, you can't get around this problem of degradation of DNA by saying, well, maybe conditions were different back a long, long time ago. It seems that, you know, random mutation always has a propensity to break genes. And if it helps, then natural selection will select those.
You say that we need to talk about the existence of the mind and how we recognize the effects of a mind at work. Why is that, Dr. Behe?
All thinking people since pretty much the beginning of recorded history until the middle of the 19th century thought, if you look at the wonders of biology in particular, nature in general, biology in particular, you see things that look designed. Well, what do we mean designed? Well, again, design is recognized by a purposeful arrangement of parts. If we see parts that are put together and they're just not random, they look like they can do things together that they couldn't do separately. Well, life is just chock full of that sort of stuff. You can just look at eyeballs, and they've been talked about, you know, for 2,000 years. And design is pretty much another word for mind and intelligence. That is, when we see different pieces put together in a purposeful arrangement, we recognize a mind behind that. So everybody in history until recently recognized that there was a mind behind life. Well, it turns out that when Darwin proposed his theory of evolution, he specifically wanted to say that this could happen, that life could have arisen and evolved without any intelligent input, without any mind whatsoever. And as I try to explain in the last chapter of the book, Darwin Devolves, that kind of a necessary side effect of that claim that life could arise without mind is that we lose the ability to recognize even our own minds. And that is that in academia these days, there's a strong movement, and it seems to be the accepted position or the politically correct position to say, well, humans don't really have minds, that are what we think of them. It's just our brain, and our brain just working by physical mechanisms, and we don't really have free will or any of the things that people typically associate with a mind. So that idea of Darwin's, that life developed without any intelligent input, actually boomerangs, and now we are just physical systems, not a whole lot different than rocks and so on. But I write now that we see that Darwin was pretty much just being very, very optimistic, that there never was any evidence that his mechanism could do what he claimed for it. Now we can say that we recognize the mind behind life, that it takes a mind and certainly a super intelligent mind to be able to arrange all of the parts that are necessary for all the kinds of life on Earth.
Why do you say that evolutionary biology has hit a brick wall?
Well, science and biology in particular have made great leaps and bounds in the past 50, 60 years. You know, Watson and Crick discovered the shape of DNA, and we've learned to clone organisms and genes and all sorts of medical breakthroughs. But the question of know, how did these things arise? Not how do they work, but how do they arise, is a separate question. And it turns out that we are as stumped by that question now as we were 50 years ago. Absolutely no progress has been made in explaining how complex functional systems could arise by random processes in the past half century, even though science has made wonderful strides in explaining how things work. We can't understand how life could have arisen by random processes. And so it makes you think that maybe we're barking up the wrong tree here, and maybe it's time to broaden our search a bit.
Are there any genuinely alternate theories of life that perhaps even just behind closed doors, disillusioned evolutionary biologists are either thinking of or even considering?
Well, there are two basic explanations for life. And one is that it's a big accident. And number two is that an intelligence, a mind, is behind life. There are some variations of Darwin's theory and alternative forms of that, but they all, at bottom, rely on chance and accident to try to explain life. So, for reasons I describe in the book, none of them succeed. The second possibility, that life is not an accident, that it's the result of purpose, that it was intended, it's the product of a mind, fits, for reasons I talk about, very well with the data we have. It leaves a lot of questions open, like how was this done and when was it done and all sorts of other interesting things. But the basic conclusion of purposeful design is the only other possibility than the accidental idea, and the idea that life arose accidentally.
Dr. Michael Behe is professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University, founding senior fellow of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Education. He's author of several books, including his latest, Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution. When you purchase this book using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, and look for Darwin Devolves by Dr. Michael Behe. Dr. Behe, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. It was great to be with you.
We'll be playing Issues, Etc. Soundbite of the Week on the other side of the break. We've got our four soundbites. We are ready to play them. We will. And then you give us a call and vote for one of them. 1-877-623-MYIE. Stay tuned.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
LCMS Rural and Small Town Mission exists to support and encourage congregations in rural and small town settings. In partnership with LCMS districts, RSTM is uniquely positioned to make a major impact in revitalization support, community engagement and outreach training, congregational partnership development, and worker support through providing and developing resources geared specifically to rural and small town congregations. Check us out at lcms.org/RSTM or give us a call at our office. We're here to help.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Lutheran Women's Missionary League is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During March, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to the LWML. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.